This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 10, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Former corporate attorney and Supreme Court nominee John Roberts gets the support of corporate America for the court seat. A new study in Britain indicates that the system is failing to protect legal recourse for rape victims. And we'll take a look at the severe food shortage in Niger and other nations on the African continent. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Iran has broken the final UN seals at its nuclear plant Isfahan to continue uranium enrichment activities. The move comes as members of the International Atomic Energy Agency holds urgent talks on Iran's decision. Haider Rizvi has more from the United Nations.
The UN nuclear agency is authorized to refer this matter to the Security Council. But at this moment, it seems everyone wants to resolve the issue by means of continuing dialogue. Talking to reporters here at the UN headquarters, the Chinese ambassador, Wang Guanghua, indicated that his country would oppose any move to bring the issue to the Council, saying that the talks between the European Union and Iran should continue. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and the IAEA Chief Mohammed al-Bradi have also issued similar statements. Suspicious that Iran intends to build nuclear weapons, major European nations and the United States want Iran to suspend its nuclear program in return for economic and political benefits. Iran denies that it intends to develop nuclear weapons and asserts that its nuclear program is meant for generating electricity. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Israel and the Palestinian Authority agreed to crucial last-minute decisions on the Israeli pullout. Manar Jabrin reports.
Palestinian Minister of Civil Affairs Mohammad Dahlan and Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz reached an agreement Tuesday on cleaning up the rubble of the Gaza Strip settlements, set to be evacuated under the disengagement plan slated to start by midnight August 14th. The two sides agreed that Israeli army bulldozers will demolish the walls of the houses in what was described as initial demolition. Palestinian and Egyptian companies hired by the World Bank will then complete the demolition after the Israeli pullout. The rubble of the settlements will be buried in Sinai or within the Gaza Strip, while some of the remainders will be recycled for Palestinian construction in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Israeli Ministry of Environment will take care of the burial of hazardous materials, such as asbestos, in special locations within Israeli territory. The demolition process is expected to last between 1.5 to 2 months. For Free Speech Radio News from the International Middle East Media Center in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
President Bush recess-appointed Eric Edelman for the number 3 position at the Pentagon. Michael Dang has more from Washington, D.C.
This marks the third time since Congress has been out of session this summer that the president has used his executive powers to put an official on the job and bypass the Senate. Democratic senators had been blocking Edelman's nomination in order to retrieve intelligence documents from Edelman's predecessor, Douglas Feith, which contained information about unproven links between Iraq and the various terrorist groups. Feith was one of the main people who planned the invasion and reconstruction of Iraq. Former CIA official Ray McGovern says that the current administration is withholding information from the public to mask the reasons Iraq was invaded.
Clearly, it's an attempt by the administration, a successful attempt, to withhold information that is absolutely necessary for us to get a good picture as to why we invaded Iraq, or more particularly, why our Congress and our citizens were deceived into thinking it was necessary to invade Iraq.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Michael Dang.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez gave land rights to 6 indigenous groups to reverse years of injustice. Greg Wilpert reports from Caracas.
Venezuela's President Chavez provided a collective land title for over 317,000 acres of land to the Venezuelan indigenous group known as the Cariña yesterday. The collective land title is part of a larger plan to restore control over large parts of Venezuelan territory to all 15 Venezuelan indigenous peoples, which make up 1% of the country's population, before the end of the year. This is the first time in Venezuelan history that a government has recognized the land rights of its indigenous peoples. The program is based on changes in the new 1999 Venezuelan constitution, which indigenous groups help write. Greg Bulpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
House Republicans oppose a provision that would open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling to be included in a budget package. In a letter, 24 lawmakers said they would have serious concerns about a budget bill that would authorize developing ANWR. Of the $34.7 billion bill, the Resources Committee must cut $2.7 billion in programs under its authority. Lawmakers want to make the budget bill as easy as possible to pass, citing ANWR could add to the complications. ANWR was not included in the energy bill that the president signed earlier this week, partly because of the controversy that comes with it. I'm Leanne Caldwell, WPFW in Washington, D.C.
President Bush's nominee to the Supreme Court, John Roberts, has picked up a powerful endorsement today, corporate America. The National Association of Manufacturers announced it will work to get John Roberts confirmed by the Senate. As a corporate lawyer, Roberts has presented such companies as Toyota and Fox. The National Association of Manufacturers says it believes Roberts would be sensitive to the business community's needs as a Supreme Court justice. Mitch Jezerich has more from Washington.
The National Association of Manufacturers, one of the most powerful corporate lobbying groups in Washington, has put its weight behind John Roberts to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court.
Well, these are matters like contract law, employment law, regulatory issues, and property rights. Given the stakes, we can no longer sit on the sidelines.
John Engler, the former Republican governor of Michigan, is the president of the National Association of Manufacturers. He says that the corporate sector is in need of a Supreme Court justice who understands its desire to limit the number of lawsuits aimed at businesses.
With Supreme Court justices like John Roberts, we believe we can start to bring down the crushing burden of legal costs in this country, which are some 10 times that of our nearest competitor, and today cost an equivalency of about 2.3% of our gross domestic product.
This has been a great year for corporations on Capitol Hill, with the passage of measures ranging from limiting class action lawsuits to prohibiting most people from filing for bankruptcy to eliminating barriers for corporations to open up manufacturing shops in Central America. Engler says he'll use that same momentum to urge senators to support the nomination of Roberts.
We've seen when our members get involved, when they become engaged, they can have a tremendous impact. Now, I expect they can have an impact on this confirmation process.
About half of all the work conducted at the Supreme Court deals with business and the Commerce Clause. Historian Peter Irons, author of the book The People's History of the Supreme Court, explains.
The Supreme Court, ever since the New Deal era of Franklin D. Roosevelt, had interpreted it very, very broadly. Congress really has the power to regulate any aspect of business, whether it's minimum wages, Social Security, any kind of regulation, environmental regulations and others. And the court has been, over the last 10, 15 years, beginning to cut back on the commerce powers of Congress. But I think with Judge Roberts on the court, there would be an even more solid majority to continue that retrenchment on Commerce Clause issues.
And as Irons continues, the Commerce Clause gives the federal government the authority to regulate on much more than just economics.
The Supreme Court based its ruling upholding the Civil Rights Act of 1964 on the Commerce Clause, on the ground that anybody traveling between one state and another who was subjected to racial discrimination, that hindered interstate commerce. And that's the kind of ruling that most conservative groups and business in particular are very upset about.
We want to know more about what his views are on how the Supreme Court has approached the issue of definition of disability, which we believe is a very problematic history.
Daniel Davis is with the disability rights group, the National Council on Independent Living, which has yet to take a formal position. Davis says disabled activists, however, want to know more about Roberts' views of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Roberts represented Toyota in a case of the Supreme Court, which narrowed who was entitled to ADA protections by citing against a former Toyota employee who developed carpal tunnel syndrome. Again, Dan Davis.
The ADA was supposed to be done on a case-by-case basis. We don't understand why the Supreme Court has started to interpret this more as almost a benefits law rather than a civil rights law.
One right-wing group called the Public Advocate withdrew its support for Roberts today because Roberts assisted a gay and lesbian rights group in winning a Supreme Court case in 1996 that overturned a Colorado law that banned civil rights protections for homosexuals. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
A group of activists representing Iraq war veterans and their families gathered today in front of the White House to express their support for Cindy Sheehan, who lost her son in the Iraq war. As Anastasia Nestitskaya reports, Sheehan is camping near President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, demanding answers from the president on why this happened. Reverend Lennox Yearwood explains how Sheehan was informed that her son was killed.
She has gotten the knock that almost 2,000 Americans have gotten, the knock that their child has been killed in this war.
Reverend Lennox Yearwood.
Because this war is not just, and there are no weapons of mass destruction. It makes it very hard. And then when the president says that her child died for a noble cause, she just wants to ask the question, what noble cause was that?
Reverend Yearwood delivered this speech at a gathering of the supporters of Cindy Sheehan. Sheehan, willing to have a face-to-face meeting with President Bush, is parked in a ditch, living in a tent some distance from the president's ranch in Crawford. Shahid Buttar, the organizer of the event.
The weather's been inclement. She's faced harassment by law enforcement authorities claiming that the space she was camping on was private land when in fact it was not.
As the number of the war victims has been growing on both sides, including the recent deaths of 14 Marines from Ohio, more organizations are supporting Cindy's effort. Gail Murphy from a women's peace group, Code Pink.
He did his duty meeting when her son first was killed, and that was enough. Now, a lot has happened. We've had the 9/11 commission that has whitewashed reports. We have the Downing Street Minutes, tortures in Abu Ghraib. We have so much that has come out of this war. We all have questions, and Cindy is taking the courage and the time, the opportunity, while he's on vacation at his ranch, to shine the light on the fact that these questions have not been answered and that we deserve an answer.
Yesterday, White House Representative Trent Duffy said, quote, "The National Security Advisor, as well as the Deputy Chief of Staff, met with her and other mothers for 45 minutes, unquote. Ms. Sheehan is determined to stay in Crawford until the president agrees to meet with her. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditska.
The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the convictions of five Cubans yesterday, three of whom were accused of conspiracy to commit espionage in what Cuba and the United Nations say was an unfair trial. The three justices on the appeals court agreed and ordered a new one. Joseph Muti reports on reaction from Cuba.
Not since the order to return the Cuban child, Elian Gonzalez, have Cubans been so overjoyed by news from the United States. Fernando, Antonio, Gerardo, René, and Ramón are household names here. Their imprisonment for infiltrating terrorist groups such as Brothers to the Rescue, the Cuban-American National Foundation, and the paramilitary Omega 7 and Alpha 66 groups in Miami is seen by Cubans as a massive injustice. The president of the Cuban parliament, Ricardo Alarcón, told the press that the five should be immediately released pending a new trial and that what he termed the lies and deceit of the last 7 years be exposed to the U.S. public.
The first step is to put an end to their incarceration. We're talking 7 years of arbitrary imprisonment that now the courts say was unjust, incorrect, and had no value, and that the entire trial must be held again. So the first step is to free them.
Ricardo Alarcón added that another trial would expose the political ramifications of the first and show just why the Cuban Five, as they are known, were arrested in the first place.
To protect the terrorists in Miami, this is apparent in the documents presented by the U.S. government at the trial, by the charges, by the very attorney general prosecuting the case, and by the sentences. This is a case against five people who were punished for no more nor less than fighting against U.S. terrorism.
Cuba has long charged the United States government with funding paramilitary groups that attack it and tolerating their open operations from U.S. soil. Roberto Gonzalez is an attorney and the brother of one of the five, René Gonzalez. He agreed with the Cuban parliament president. He said the importance of the decision will hopefully raise consciousness in the United States about the U.S. government's treatment of Cuba.
This will help us in that people with doubts, people a little distanced from the issue of the five, will look at the case. U.S. public opinion will see that something bad has happened. The trial was wrong. There is something worrying there.
Former CIA agent Phil Agee, who wrote an expose of the type of CIA subversive operations carried out by the U.S. government against Cuba, understands the great deal of influence the Miami right-wing wields in Washington.
I've never heard of a foreign group of exiles or refugees coming to the United States and taking over United States policy toward their country of origin. And this is, I think, unique. These Cuban extremists, who are so fanatical about the revolution here in Cuba, dictate United States policy. And that is another reflection on the functioning of the United States government.
The families of the five Cubans were understandably the happiest at hearing the news ordering their retrial. Two of their children, Tony Guerrero and Irma Gonzalez, are in Venezuela attending the World Youth Festival.
I'm feeling very emotional and don't have the words to express so much happiness, so much joy. Dad, I want to send you all my love and a kiss.
Irma was in tears.
More than ever, I'm excited that he may soon be back here with us, with my sister, with my mother. I'm very happy, and with a lot of hope.
For Free Speech Radio, in Havana, I'm Joseph Mutti.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org.
The World Food Program is trying to distribute food to 2.5 million people affected by the food crisis in the West African state of Niger. The United Nations warns that millions of people in other African countries are also facing a severe food shortage. The UN wants to eradicate extreme hunger by 2015 under its Millennium Development Goals, but international commitment to combat hunger in Africa is doubtful. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The food crisis in Niger has persisted for several months. International assistance is only coming after tens of thousands of people risk dying of hunger. Philip Brown of the United Nations Development Programme says the crisis would have been better handled if the world had responded promptly.
I think this was a preventable occurrence. But, you know, the problem I think with some of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa is that there's a level of donor fatigue. And so there isn't adequate attention paid to these problems as they develop. And it's only when they become an emergency that people respond. And then it's actually too late for a lot of people.
Besides Niger, many other African countries like Mauritania, Mali, Chad and Burkina Faso are also facing severe food shortage. The affected countries are some of the poorest in the world. Some of those affected by the food crisis are dying from poverty and hunger. Juliana Omale is from Kenya, where the eastern parts of the country have been facing perennial food crisis.
Actually, hunger is a real problem. When you look at the dynamics also that are going on, in the sense that Kenya, over 60% of the population live on less than a dollar a day. For some people, even just scrounging for one meal a day is really an issue. It's a matter of life or death.
Poor rains and locust invasion are blamed for the food crisis in Africa. But Christy van der Westhuizen of the Institute for Global Dialogue, a body which monitors international trade, says World Bank and IMF policies, which make countries on the continent to produce cash crops for export rather than food crops for local consumption, is also to blame. She says cash crops like cotton and coffee are now taking large expanse of farmlands on the continent.
Those products then take up most of the arable land that you find in a given country, instead of the land being used to produce for local consumption. So when you go through a difficult period, or you've had extended droughts, or any environmental upheaval or problem, then populations easily pushed over the edge into food insecurity.
The United Nations has set 2015 as a year to end severe hunger and other problems which affect people in developing countries. On September 14, the World Body will begin a summit in New York to review the implementation of its plans to combat such problems as hunger, poverty, and disease. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
From his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Mumia Abu-Jamal brings us this commentary.
When raising consciousness ain't enough. The images of voracious famine leaking out of the steamy deserts of the northwest African nation of Niger cuts to the souls quick. Babies barely able to grasp a breath. Mothers with breasts as flat and milkless as boys. Dizzy with hunger, laid low in the barren dust, awaiting whatever release that either death or food may bring. Fathers weeping because there is a relentless drought, and there is nothing, nothing to feed one's wife, one's children, one's aged mother. This is Niger, 2005, and according to broadcast reports, it'll take some 4 weeks or perhaps more for any food relief to reach the nation. It is a telling reflection of the lives we live that here, in the heart of the empire, there are millions of people who have so much to eat that the fastest growing health threat is morbid obesity and its equally serious cousin, diabetes. Billions of dollars are spent annually on the latest fad diet, carbo diets, Atkins diets, grapefruit diets, and, if I'm not mistaken, a donut diet. Okay, I'm joking about the last one, but just barely. What's wrong with this picture? How the world is organized and how the world's economic business is done is what's wrong. Clearly, some people have too much. Others have nothing. One also couldn't look face on at these pictures without thinking almost immediately of the recent worldwide music concerts, which were designed to raise consciousness, not money, about the starving millions in Africa. As I looked at these famished people, babies so weak and drawn by hunger that they could no longer eat, as one girl's tender mouth was a nest of parasites eating her tiny body alive, and wondered about the concerts that were designed to raise consciousness about the plight of the starving. It reminded me that we live in an age when TV becomes not merely an image, but a fact. Millionaire musicians stage concerts around the globe, pulling in billions to the international media conglomerates, showing how nice and progressive and caring these stations are, while perhaps 600,000 people in one country will starve to death by week's end. Madness. Media madness. Corporate madness. Capitalist madness. With perhaps 0.01% of the monies used to stage the broadcast blockbuster event, virtually all of these people could have been fed and saved to live at least through the rainy season. No doubt, these heart-rending pictures of human suffering will yet raise billions for organizations, NGOs, and charity agencies, and will continue to do so long after these specific men, women, and children will have ceased living on this earth. Briefly consider the state of the world's wealth and poverty. 1.3 billion people lack access to clean water. 1.2 billion live on less than a dollar a day. 840 million are malnourished. More than 20,000 people die each day from hunger-related diseases. The richest three people in the world have assets greater than the combined output of the 48 poorest countries. That's just several excerpts from Jeremy Seabrook's The No-Nonsense Guide to Class, Caste, and Hierarchies. We live in a world where madness passes for normalcy, where the raging logic of the marketplace leaves tens and hundreds of millions of people in dire peril, and the gap between rich and poor grows exponentially daily. Yet, like little Neros, we play musical accompaniments to massacres of hunger, which can be prevented with virtual ease. But this is Africa, Niger, poor people, agricultural people. These are expendable people. These are but flickering images on a screen. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
A British study into the attrition rates in rape cases has found that it is now much more difficult to convict than ever before. The study found an increasing number of plaintiffs dropped their cases even before reaching court, leading to concerns that the present judicial system is failing to protect rape victims. Helen Kelly reports from London.
Rape in the UK is a low-risk crime, and law enforcement is systematically failing rape victims. That's a damning conclusion of a recent study by the Home Office, which demonstrates that the conviction rate for serious sexual assault is plummeting. In the 1970s, there was a 33% chance of conviction. In 1985, it was 24%. And in the most recent 2003 figures, that number was just 5.3%. The main problem, says writer and anti-violence campaigner of 25 years Julie Bindell, is an outdated idea of what rape is.
We have this whole myth about rape, which is so prevalent that the only thing that you can call rape is the stranger who attacks and inflicts additional violence. That there is a lower grade of rape, which the US calls, and now the UK calls, date rape. And this is so dangerous because the majority of rapes is committed by known men, many of whom are in relationships with women.
That stereotype also works to limit the definition of rape, and by default, of victims as well. It also makes it very difficult for juries to convict. And if alcohol is involved, or if the victim is wearing what the court considers inappropriate clothing, or has enjoyed a healthy sex life in the past, then a conviction becomes even less likely. And that has had a devastating effect throughout the British legal system. Police and prosecutors routinely overestimate the number of false allegations in rape cases, losing the confidence of complainants, while the Home Office research shows only 3% of rape allegations are false. Despite a change in law in 2000 to prevent victims' sexual past being used to argue that they must have consented to sex, standards often slide in the courtroom. Linda Reagan, who co-authored the Home Office report, lays the blame on a legal culture skewed against victims.
The problem is we have an adversarial justice system, which is about proving beyond reasonable doubt that somebody is guilty. It's actually very difficult to prove non-consent. It's particularly difficult to prove non-consent if your idea of what rape is outside by a stranger with a knife and there being injuries.
The UK government is aware of these failures in the system and is considering how to reverse the trend of low conviction. However, many campaigners argue it is doing too little, too late. The reality is that most police authorities in the UK still do not have access to a specialised rape investigation suite, and there is no systematic approach to handling sexual assault accusations. The first step for many is securing funding for a nationwide awareness campaign to dispel the myths surrounding rape. Because until police, prosecutors and the public hold a more realistic view of who rapists are, then the system will continue to fail rape victims. And rape in the UK will remain a low-risk crime. Helen Kelly, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Zimba Russo. Our headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, McMillan, and Eric Klein. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.